good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we tell you each week, our conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us tonight, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. All this week on The Conversation, we've talked with communities across the country and heard national voices about homelessness. We've asked about the best practices that go beyond those words, best practices. How are communities using them to make headway in all types of homelessness, veteran, mentally ill, and substance addicted, family and youth, and other homeless people that we sometimes don't talk about? And how can all of this save Hawaii time and money in responding right here? And finally, how could the changing national landscape inform where Hawaii goes from here? Continuing this week's focus on Hawaii homelessness from the outside in, three of Oahu's top homeless outreach providers join us tonight. Here's our panel. Greg Payton is here. He is the executive chair of Partners in Care. It's a planning, coordinating, and advocacy alliance that develops recommendations for programs and services to fill the needs within Oahu's continuum of care. Also joining us is Scott Fujii. He is now the interim executive director for FOCUSED. That's the membership and advocacy organization for health and human services in Hawaii. FOCUSED works with community stakeholders to make an impact on programs and policy changes. And joining us tonight is Sheila Beckham. She administers all aspects of Waikiki Health and oversees the agency's growing family of primary care clinics and outreach programs that target medically unserved populations. And you're here, too. And if you'd like to join us tonight, again, our number is 941-3689. That's the number to call from Oahu. Or if you're going to call us from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, get to us at 877-941-3689. Welcome to all of you. Thank you very much for making time tonight.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Yeah. Thank you.
All week, we've been talking about homelessness and looking at it from the lens of people who are not in Hawaii, who have done great things in their communities or who are looking at it from a national perspective and have something to tell Hawaii and how Hawaii may go forward. There have been several themes that have been coming through the week that have emerged, including looking at housing first and the idea of that being the bedrock of everything else. Also that youth, as we heard this morning when we talked to Mary Lee from Multnomah County, which is where Portland is, that trying to really get a handle on youth is very, very difficult, and that the numbers are outrageously undercounted in these counts that we see. Seeing that there are a lot of, there's a lot of work that's been done with veteran and chronic homelessness because there have been so many focuses on that and initiatives toward that, but that there are lots of permutations of these things that somehow also don't get talked about enough. And we also heard this morning from Nan Roman at the National Alliance to End Homelessness that some of the federal money may in fact be threatened, and that's happening at the same time as we're seeing a decrease in affordable, low-income affordable units nationwide. So that's some of what we've been hearing this week. What I'd like us to do tonight is put that into the perspective of Hawaii. And so, Greg, I'm going to start with you. With some of what we've been hearing tonight, how would you say that this has particular import for Hawaii as we're now looking at homelessness statewide and with the governor's leadership team on which you sit?
You know, the interesting thing that we've discovered is that as much as we are alike, we always talk about how different Hawaii is. Well, we are very much alike the rest of the country. There are many things about the data that we have that are very similar to other parts of the country, and especially things like the numbers of people who, or the percentages of people who need permanent supported housing, and that requires a lot of intensive follow-up and support. Then there's the group who need rapid rehousing, which is they need maybe 6 to 9 months of support to get back on their feet again. And then the people that need kind of basic supports, just maybe some deposit money to get realigned with housing again, basic needs. Those percentages are fairly similar across the United States.
Including Hawaii.
Including Hawaii. That's a very interesting breakdown. It's a phenomenon the way that's happened across the United States. Those statistics seem to be pretty solid across the country. Now, how you actually implement and deal with those numbers on a local level is of course the unique challenge for Hawaii, because we do not have an inventory of affordable housing here locally, and we have to be very creative in how we sell that to people. And I think the other there's some other misconceptions that are pretty pervasive everywhere across the country, which are ours as well, is that it's for those people, those providers can handle this, or it's a government problem. And it really is, this is a community issue. And we're going to have to come up with the creative ways. If there's going to be funding cuts, we always hear that, there's not enough housing. We're going to have to really be very creative in involving the community in how the community can help solve the problem.
Scott Fujii, does the community really want to be involved with this?
You know, I think that they do, and I think that it really comes down to making sure that each community understands what their role is to play. You know, this comes down to individual community members, up to nonprofit organizations, private businesses, you know, folks that are outside of the kind of typical service sphere that you look at. And I think, you know, the more data, the more that, you know, groups like Partners in Care, Waikiki Health are able to kind of get the message out of, you know, providers are doing a lot out there on an everyday basis. You know, their outreach workers are there every day, outreaching, communicating, connecting folks with resources. Where the community can really play a role in is, you know, helping come up with some of the creative solutions that Greg's alluding to about how can we get folks into housing that, you know, housing folks that were formerly, you know, are homeless currently. You know, there are wraparound supports that are available to help make sure that these folks are going to stay, you know, stably housed, and that, you know, there are some misconceptions about who's out there. And I think, you know, the starting point of that is collecting good data, which Partners in Care and all of the nonprofits that are associated with Partners in Care are really committed to. They really double down on making sure that we know who's out there.
Sheila Beckham, do we have the best data that we probably ever had? Because of this idea that a lot of providers are working together, or is there still a road to go?
We still have a long way to go with the data. Many of the outreach teams are aware of where people are, and yet the people are moving because we have sweeps and things like that. I think that with the data, you know, different groups are reporting different pieces. Maybe, you know, even though we've got the point in time count, we have other pieces of data that are being reported that may be program, data. It may be just agency data. But I think we need to get some consistent across the board information about the folks that we have. And there are a lot of misconceptions.
Like what?
Well, I think a lot of folks think that most of the homeless have just recently come from the mainland, or they have come from the Compact of Free Association.
So they're COFRA migrants, or they've come here because it's easy to be homeless in Hawaii.
It's a lot more comfortable. However, when we look at the demographics that are, say, in the Kaka'aku encampment, or we look at many of our homeless facilities, there are a good 50% of those people that are local people that have been raised here all their lives.
Greg, didn't we see that come out in some of the data very recently when there was a count done in Kaka'ako that it was only about 30% who were COFA migrants. Everybody else was, you know, Hawaiian or Samoan, or, you know, not the group that people wanted to point toward.
That's exactly right. Actually, Scott was very instrumental in pulling that information together. So we found that it was kind of a phenomenon. We knew. Let me talk about what I call the Kaka'ako phenomenon to start with. There's encampments. Encampments are very common. That's another common thing that happens with homeless communities across the United States. People think it's not just Hawaii. It's so common that the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness just published a document on it 2 weeks ago.
Right. We talked with Matt Doherty about that.
About what encampments are. The interesting thing about the encampment in Kaka'ako is that usually encampments have kind of like people together. And that's not what Kaka'aka was. It was a broad mix. So, for example, the organization, my day job organization at Mental Health Kakua, we had some of our clients were there that we actually do outreach with and serve those adults, single adults with mental illness. Then we had families that were there, and then we had COFA people that were there, and then we had families with small children. Now, that's a unique development in and of itself, and that's an important priority of folks to be served. But Scott may have a little more information on the breakdown of COFA, for example.
Yeah, and I think, you know, hats off to the outreach organizations like Waikiki Health and Kalihi Palama and Mental Health Kōkua, who really took the time to really delve into it and get an accurate account. And, you know, like we're talking about having good data, knowing who we're serving, who we're working with, who we're trying to house. They really stepped up big in this instance around Kakaako and continue on an everyday basis across the island. And really what we're seeing is, you know, these are a broad ranging mix. I mean, this is really, it's almost a microcosm of the wider picture of who we're trying to serve island wide, because you've got folks across the spectrum. And really what we're looking at is how do we then, if we're looking at addressing this microcosm, how do we make sure that we've got the right supports in place that we can refer families with young children, individuals with mental illness, you know, just individuals who are struggling with affordability. You know, that's a major factor with the folks that we're seeing there with very low incomes, you know, and very low education levels. And that's, you know, going to take a support additionally with housing to get into housing, but also what are the other supports that are going to be necessary to make sure they can sustain housing? How do they increase their education and their earning capacity? You know, what kind of mental health supports are needed to really serve those populations?
When we look at bringing together communities, I mean, our greater community as in all of Hawaii, different islands, one of the themes that also emerged in the conversation that we've had this week is that we need to look for, as Beth Sander called them, unusual suspects. She's from mm-hmm. Community Solutions, and we were talking about some of the programs that they've been working with and that Honolulu and Hawaii have been participating in, both a 100,000 home program that ended last year when we first talked to her, and then more recently the involvement in the Zero 2016 program. But this idea of unusual suspects who will buy together into a vision and be able to move the needle on homelessness, how much do you think that is something that we can do with Hawaii? Are there unusual suspects out there still?
Unusual suspects in terms of people that might be able to support our efforts?
Yes, she meant people not who are the traditional group of people who you would be going to be able to create a movement toward ending homelessness, or people who have been traditionally involved with it, but looking at it from, in a lot of ways, the dollars and cents that, you know, some estimates will say that it's 40% cheaper to be able to house people who are homeless than to manage them.
And I think, you know, Partners in Care as a collaborative network of nonprofit service providers is a great example of that. You know, when we started this you know, really concentrated effort to coordinate among service providers, you know, across the spectrum, we also took a hard look at saying, okay, well, who else is interacting with homeless individuals that may not consider themselves homeless service providers on a primary basis, but are very much interacting with that population? And, you know, healthcare systems are a big part of that. And I think that's where a large part of the cost that you're referencing comes in is, you know, if you can stabilize somebody in housing, you know, how can you see the healthcare costs coming through emergency room visits start to decrease?
Right, that's part of it too. But then again, if you start to lump in all the other costs, the cost of sweeps, which we're told are, what, $750,000 annually. And then if you have a lawsuit, like we now have a lawsuit with the ACLU, well, the city's going to have to pony up and be able to pay for that too. Those costs also get bundled into what it costs to be able to manage homeless people rather than to house them, according to some of the people that we've talked to this week.
Yeah, and those are definitely costs associated with what I think, you know, a lot of folks on your show earlier this week have mentioned as managing homelessness as opposed to ending homelessness. And I think, you know, while those efforts, you know, do come at a cost, I think it has to be across the spectrum of looking at, you know, short, medium, and long-term, you know, costs in terms of, you know, if you house somebody immediately, are you hedging off future costs, you know, and you know, the longer somebody, you know, stays on the street, and the data supports this, is, you know, as they spend 1, 3, 5, 10, you know, even longer than that on the streets, you know, health conditions are harder to manage, you know, and so you're going to see increases in that. You're going to see, you know, decompensation in terms of mental health and behavior health.
Greg?
Well, some of the other unusual suspects that we've uncovered here locally, and it's I think these are the positive stories that can come out of this. And they're just happening now, as we've been talking more in the last few months, and this has become more of a public issue. For example, civic groups that I really did not anticipate at all was going to happen. I just happened to be talking to a couple of them. You know, you do the program piece at a civic group, and they said, well, how can we help? And so I hadn't even really, I mean, personally, I don't know why that never occurred to me, but so we got together and we were thinking, well, what is one of the biggest barriers for a landlord to rent to somebody who's homeless? Well, there's basically three things. You're going to guarantee their rent, you're going to fix the repairs, and who's going to be there to respond to emergency problems? And so what the civic group said, well, how about if we got together and pooled some money and put some money together as kind of an insurance pool? So if there's damages, you've got a pool of money there to help cover it. Well, now, who saw that one coming? That's a very good idea. We talked with one of the local hospitals about their what they call frequent flyers. These are the people that are homeless with co-occurring medical disorders. How many is that? It's about 81% of the population. Besides mental health, they might have other co-occurring problems. And so they end up in the emergency room.
When you say 81% of the population, you're talking about of the overall homeless population?
Yes. So they end up, and again, those numbers move, but it's been pretty consistent, and that's a pretty consistent number across the country. Why? It's just what Scott just said. People have been on the streets for usually more than 12 months, usually sometimes a couple of years, a few years, and their health conditions are just not being taken care of. And so what we talked with one of the hospitals, well, what could we do as a provider? And we thought, well, you know, as a provider, you could actually divert those folks to one of our 24-hour facilities, and we could take care of them for you. They could come in to us for at least for a few days to get stable. That's saving at least $3,000 a day in services. So there's that angle. There's the issue of I had somebody come up to me after a public speaking event, and he said, you know, what do you need? You need a house? You need a building? I can help you invest. He says, I'm only half a do-gooder. I need to make my money back, but tell me what I can do. And so we talked about maybe investing in a small apartment complex where we could actually place people as a project-based kind of location. Landlords are a tough sell because, as I said, this is not a warm and fuzzy topic. How do you encourage a landlord who could get, you know, commercial rate rents somewhere else from somebody else? How are you going to encourage them to rent to somebody that's homeless and somebody that's homeless with mental illness, for example? And so having families and veterans as being, it's kind of one of the, you know, a couple of the top priorities as takedown targets is very helpful. Those are populations you can wrap your hands around. You can really see that. You can have empathy for that. And it gives the community a feeling of success. We've done something here.
If you're just joining us now for Town Square tonight, we are continuing our look at homelessness in Hawaii from the outside in. But this time we're looking at it from the inside, too. We have joining us tonight Greg Payton, who you just heard speaking a moment ago. He's the executive chair of Partners in Care and the CEO of Mental Health Kōkua. And also with us tonight is Sheila Beckham from Waikiki Health. They manage Next Step Shelter and others. And we have with us Scott Fujii, now the interim executive director for Focused. And you too. Here's our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Homelessness has become one of the big issues in Hawaii. We've been seeing a lot more coverage of it in the last year, ostensibly because of what has been happening in Kaka'ako, to be sure. But in general, is this now an issue whose time has come for a lot of people to wrap their heads around it in unusual ways, as you were just hearing Greg Payton talk about? We want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Sheila Beckham, as you go out and you're seeing this on a day-to-day basis, particularly with youth, how much more difficult would it be to find an unusual suspect who would be willing to help youth versus, say, a family? Do youth sort of get the lowest order there on the pecking order?
Actually, we have facilities. I mean, we have clinics that, you know, primarily work with these various different groups. We have our youth outreach group, which is youth that comes there. They get hot meals, showers, they get job training. And we do have a group that is working together to try to bring some funding to get a residential facility for the youth outreach.
So that's a really clear need, to be having a home or someplace where they could be housed, not just come in and get services and be able to get clean and get fed, but also to be able to have a real roof over their heads.
It's true, but I think that part of the model of a federally qualified community health center, which Waikiki Health is that you get a bundle of services. So our patients can walk off the street, or they can schedule appointments, come in for various clinical visits, primary care, some specialty services. They can have behavioral health. They can have some social service support. And they can have, you know, substance abuse treatment counseling. So we've got different facilities, and we work together with our shelter, with our outreach team that actually takes these services out to the folks that are on, you know, the streets. So we, if we can engage them and get them interested, we can get them into at least temporary and transitional housing, and then we work on a housing case management plan.
All right, we have a person calling us from the Big Island, preferring to be anonymous. Welcome to Town Square. Thanks for the call.
Hi, I'm calling anonymously because I am, quote, unquote, homeless. I do own property. But, you know, when the system itself is so subsidized that the rents are more than what people get paid at their job, I mean, it's an underlying problem beyond, you know, assistance from government and assistance from, you know, just serving food. I mean, here on Big Island, I'm employed. I had the same job for 20 years. And actually transferred between islands with that job. But if you have, when you're just serving people, it's kind of counterintuitive because, you know, there's a lot of places here, maybe not so much on Oahu, where you could establish community gardens. And, you know, the more that folks have an esteem where they feel good about going out and doing something and not being looked down at like a different caste.
Caller, can I ask you a question?
It actually runs a little bit deeper than just, you know, providing assistance and whatnot. It actually, in my opinion, needs providing opportunity and not just having the ultra-wealthy be able to collect a Section 8. Because Section 8 will pay more than $1,000. There's no rental less than $1,000.
Caller, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
You said that you own property, but you're homeless. So,
well, I own property, my property, and actually it's been on, you know, I lived on other islands. It just, even building, I mean, I'm building, you know, but I can't drive 100 miles every day to go to work.
So it's too remote from where you're now working, and
well,
so
you know, that's another thing. I mean, the jobs, right? So the jobs are not an opportunity because, like, say for example, you go to Costco, the primary or the majority of the food is imported. You know, so this becomes like beyond just the economics of whether or not there's housing. It goes to the point where, you know, it's imported items.
Okay, I hear you, but I think we're getting a little further afield from where we are on this. I think you're bringing the point to not enough housing that's affordable, even with people who are working like you. And I think the problem that we understand that she's saying is that although she owns property, it's very far away from where her job is, and that's not going to be a sustainable commute. So she's trying to live someplace else, can't find a place, and so that's why she finds herself homeless. Is this story that extraordinary?
There are fascinating facts here. One that just happened this last week, it's one that Scott and I worked on. The question came up, for example, let me just back up a little bit and give you the backstory. A couple of weeks ago, in my organization, we did a job fair at the expo here at the Blaisdell. A woman came up to me, had two kids, and she was saying, I need a job. Well, would you guys have, you know, openings for somebody with very little education? I said, sure, we do. We have locations all over Oahu. Where would you like to work? I said, where do you live? She said, in my car. And it was like, that, I mean, I work in this field, and that stunned me. So I was talking to Scott about this issue, and so lo and behold, we found out, Scott probably has the exact number, there's over tonight, right now, tonight, over 900 people are homeless living in their cars right now, today.
Say that one again.
Over 900 people live in their cars.
Live in the car.
And they're homeless. And that, so let me give you another twist on that. So here at my organization, Mental Health Kakua, we manage the public restrooms in Palwalhi Holly in Chinatown. It's one of the mayor's initiatives. And so in the morning, about 10 to 15 people every morning, the first people that come in to take a shower are people that have full-time jobs, but they're homeless because they do not make enough money to be able to afford a place to live. So there's questions like that that surface, like, so is that okay? Is that the society that we want to foster, is a society where you can work full-time and you have to live on the streets?
So data that we just you know, discovered a few months ago indicated that in order to get a two-bedroom apartment, you would need to make $34.81 an hour working. Now, if you have those two little children, you know, who's watching them, you know, when you're working, and if it's a husband and wife, chances are they're not even working full-time able to bring in that kind of money.
Stuck all the way around.
Yeah, it's really a difficult situation. And yet, you know, of course, we have, you know, very, very expensive penthouses that are being built. And so, you know, just some sort of partnership there to me would be really, really, really special.
Well, we're going to take some more callers. And if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open now, 941-3689, 941-3689, if you call us from Oahu, call that number. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. We're going to Jalu calling us from Honolulu. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you very much. And I first would like to applaud the actions of Waikiki Health in helping everybody and getting things done. But I would like to direct this question to Ms. Beckham. One of the problems people face, I think, is they don't want to go into a shelter, and because they're not respected and aren't treated with dignity so much or compassion. One, what is Waikiki Health doing anything to train their employees in being compassionate and respectful and treating people with dignity?
And this is the same point that I think we heard from our caller just before you too, Jalo, the idea that there should be a sense of you know, peerage about this, that this is a person and not just someone that you're treating.
And we are working towards that on a daily basis. We do it at all our clinics. We have a special program now where we're treating, you know, teaching some leadership skills and communication skills so that we can work better. And we're trying to not punish, you know, the members at our shelter. We're trying to embrace them and look at ways to build their self-esteem through job training. We even have a sewing program teaching people how to sew, you know, pretty intricate kinds of things, housing case management. So I think that the skills are there, but you're right. We have to always do that. But even in our clinic on a daily basis, we have to treat each other with dignity, and you know it's very, very important, regardless what your position is.
And how do you ratchet that out to the rest of the community? Because there are a lot of people who say, "Well, you know, those people over there, there's no sense of connection to those people."
Just one other kind of related thing to that, and this is the power of data that Scott and I have talked about so many times. The power of data is kind of interesting because what we discovered is in the analysis of Kaka'ako, for example, and Wahiwa. Some of the interesting things that came out of that was that, we have shelter space open, so how come it's not all being used? And so we drilled down into that to figure out what the problem is. And the issue was actually two things. It was privacy and amenities. So it's not that people didn't want to go into a shelter. It was this, if you're going to go into a shelter and sleep literally 1 foot from the person next to you and there's no shower there, I would just as soon stay in my tent on the street. So the solution to that was, well, in the shelters that did not have that, how about we put in some partitions and maybe bring in some mobile restrooms and showers? So I mean, it was a simple solution, but the data is what helped us find that, and Scott and Focused was very helpful with that.
We're going to take some more callers. If you'd like to join us, 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We have a group here together with us around the table tonight of some of Oahu's top service providers to people who are homeless. They've got lots of data and lots of information. If you've got a question about that and you want to get a real answer, give us a call, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Dan, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Dan. Welcome to Town Square. Dan, you there? Oops. Dan, are you there? Okay. I'm hearing a lot of backfeed on that line. Dan, if you can hear us and you're listening to your radio and you want to call us back, you can do that. And just make sure, please, you turn down your radio. Otherwise, we get a lot of nasty backfeed and we can't hear you. Going to Steve, calling us from Manoa. Aloha, Steve. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello. Thank you. Someone who goes swimming in near Kapi'olani Park most days and seeing all the homeless in Waikiki and all around, I know that there's families out there that are under distress. But what I tend to see usually are people that are schizophrenic, that are burnt out on drugs, that are just chronically homeless, that sort of like to park on the sidewalk or on the street, and they're just, it just seems like they just need to be taken care of. They're like children. It's like people talk about how these people should be able to do what they want, but do we let our three-year-old walk into the street? We help them. We don't let them eat out of garbage cans, and we don't let them steal. It seems like we're enabling many homeless to steal. We don't do anything when they steal the garbage carts or the shopping carts, or if they leave all their stuff in litter where anybody else in the past always got fined.
All right, let's see what our panel has to say. Go ahead.
I don't mind paying more taxes for facilities for these people. I don't at all. And also health care and job training. But I think it's all got to go hand in hand. And we just can't be enabling certain people to have a chronic lifestyle on the streets.
Okay, that's the point.
Extra taxes to help this.
And we're glad to hear that part, too. And thanks very much, Steve, for the call. Let's get to his point about enabling, because that seems to be the crux of the matter with him, that, okay, he's willing to pony up if it were necessary to be able to do that, but he doesn't want to see us do things that just enable people. I don't think, from what I've heard all this week with the people that we've talked to, that enabling is really at the base of all of this. Is it in any way that you see, Scott?
You know, I don't see that providers or the governments are enabling anybody to have those kinds of lifestyles that is being described by the caller. But I think what we're really talking about is making sure that we have the right support services and interventions available for folks who are suffering, from severe mental illness or who are dealing with a severe substance abuse issue, and really making sure that we can wrap those services around them. You know, one of the big issues, you know, and I know this has come up on your earlier programs, around the Housing First model, is making sure that we can really make sure that someone has the supports that they need to remain stably housed, whether that means, you know, having somebody that they can crisis call, you know, on a regular basis, if they're having a, you know, mental health or behavioral health issue, making sure that they're getting the wraparound support services they need to address substance abuse issues. I know that, you know, Greg in his quote unquote day job, you know, has a lot of clients that are coming through their doors that they're serving on a regular basis. But I think the bottom line is you want to make sure that you can get them into housing, because it's very, very difficult. And I think any clinician or any outreach worker will tell you this, to give consistent services if you can't regularly find your clients. And housing is one of the ways that you can do that.
He also mentioned the issue about, you know, safety. They're down there with their little child, and they don't want to be able to feel that this is not a safe environment. A lot of people feel that way. They have that sense of, oh, it's not just looking at it from the perspective of, well, how can we help this person, but in a way feeling fear from those people. How do you answer when you have people who surely tell you the very same thing?
It's a natural reaction, and I think it's an honest reaction that people have. There's folks out there who are very psychiatrically disabled. We see them every day, the people that are obviously confused and disoriented, and sometimes they have even defecated on themselves, yelling at people that no one else may be seeing. Those are the people that are very psychiatrically impaired. Those are the folks that we serve at Mental Health Kukui and our Safe Haven program every single day. We have 25 beds. We have another 25 people that come into our day program every day. We serve over 100 unduplicated people a year. It's a drop in the bucket for what really needs to happen. The issue is several things. First of all, I hear the caller's frustration, and that's very real because I understand that. If we had 10 safe havens, we would fill them all up. For example, let me give you a quick example. We, at our Safe Haven program, we partner with River of Life, for example, in Chinatown. River of Life said, hey, we have this extra house that we're not using adequately. Would you be able to use it? It was in Kalihi. We said, okay, well, yeah, let's get together. We opened the house, and within a week it was full. It's just that kind of thing, so we increased our capacity. The issue that happens are a couple of things. One is it takes us a while as providers to engage somebody on the street. It takes anywhere from a few days to sometimes a couple of months to engage somebody to get them to trust us. Many of them have been victimized, so they come into our services that way. And the other is there is an involuntary treatment law which is not enforced, and that would be very helpful for some of the folks that the caller described. And there very rarely does somebody become violent, but they are scary. And they're scared of local businesses, and it's not good for the business. It's not good for our community.
Well, we have lots of folks in our community who want to talk to all of you, so we're going to get back to some of the callers. Dave calling us now from Kaneohe. Aloha, Dave. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. You know what? I'd call this crimes against humanity. The mentally and the physically handicapped, the responsibility of the states and the federal government to be taking to provide the funding to make sure these people aren't having to live a very lousy life. And this is really a crime against humanity. And here's what we need to do. The whole paradigm of housing needs to change so that, okay, people that want a high-end real estate market, great. But most of us don't want that. What we want is this basic housing that we're not interested in making a profit off of the damn housing. We're interested in having the house to live in, and we need to have a whole change in that whole paradigm. And I'll leave you with this. It's outrageous, and it's just it's despicable. It's the way we treat our most vulnerable, and plus, remember, they're the most politically vulnerable too, because they can't even afford a cell phone, or have any kind of political influence. Most of them don't even vote because they don't even have a darn address.
Dave,
any comments?
We'll get some comments for you. Thank you so much for the call.
Sure.
Okay, he's going back to something that I think you said a little bit earlier, Sheila, when you said, well, we've got a lot of luxury housing, and we talked about this over the week with several of our guests on the morning show from the mainland saying, look, you know, we're seeing this shift toward real luxury housing on Oahu and not nearly enough units being either developed or fixed, those 400 that are still sort of languishing out there needing to be fixed. What do you do when people's minds are moving in a very different direction and yet we have a very real problem? And he's saying that this, in his view, our caller, is really, in his estimation, a crime against humanity.
And for me, it's not enough to just build, quote, affordable housing, because there's affordable housing for people that they'll never be able to make $60,000 a year or $80,000 a year. But when you have a $50 million penthouse, maybe we should assess a larger percent of the overall cost of that and put that into a pool for building real affordable houses. And likewise, maybe give tax credits for folks that do rent out, you know, portions of their home or their, you know, apartment buildings.
I mean, this is not like Hawaii Kai that may have a rental of $1,500 or $2,300 that somebody who is working in a job to be able to afford that is lucky enough to get. We saw that happen just in this last week. This is talking about at a very, very different level, which means we always go back and say, what does the word affordable really mean? All right, we're going to move on. Going to Cecil calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Cecil. Thank you for your patience.
Aloha. Listen, I just had a quick question regarding past public housing projects that are in need of repair. Could you give me an idea of how many of those there are and how come those aren't first of all, why are they in need of repair? Why weren't the people who built them and made the money doing it, even though it was public housing, why weren't they required to maintain it and make sure that it had a long lifetime?
All right. Thanks very much for the question. We did a reality check on this, I think, a couple months back. But correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, that we're talking about roughly 400 units that are either in the pipeline to be fixed, in some stage of being fixed, but they're not habitable now.
Yeah, that's correct. That's the latest estimate. And I think, you know, one factor of that is it does cost money to bring units back up to cost and repair. And I think Public Housing Authority has been trying to find different ways and creative means to cut some of those costs to get those units back online. I think they very much recognize the need is out there for public housing that's essentially affordable housing for the folks that Sheila was just referencing. I mean, that's the kind of affordability that they're looking for. And so I think, you know, in a medium to long-term solution, getting those units back online does factor in to our overall affordable housing dilemma.
So how do you perhaps attract one of these unusual suspects? What's in it for them to be able to do it? What incentive is there for someone to come and help with that?
You know, I think it's really about kind of going back to what Greg was also saying. It's a community effort. You know, it's recognizing that as a member of a community, if you have the ability to, you know, offer up your skills as for repairs, you know, if you can work with the Public Housing Authority. And I think, you know, Hakeem Huansafi, who's their executive director, has really tried to find different creative solutions to getting around, you know, repairing things basically on the cheap but up to code, you know, and donating their time and their energy in that effort.
It sounds like you're talking about a sort of a Habitat for Humanity effort on steroids.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, we're really going to have to look at an immediate to long-term solution around affordable housing. That's exactly the kind of effort that we're going to need. You know, last year, one of the things that Focus advocated for was an infusion of money into the Rental Housing Trust Fund, which is designed to pump money into affordable housing, to allow developers to have cheap, affordable loans to build affordable housing units. And I think, you know, we need to continue that momentum. You know, it's not about a one-time infusion. It's about a continuous commitment from the community, from the government, from providers to keep that going.
Because we're so far behind the curve of what's needed and what will be needed.
Right.
Okay, we're going to go back to some of our callers. Tom calling us from Honolulu. Welcome to Town Square.
Yeah, hi. You know, I appreciate all the different discussions that they have, and I really appreciate what the state and the governor is doing right now by maybe converting some of these containers to housing for the real immediate people that need it, and even passing a law where people can build a second or develop out a second unit on their property. You know, I'm a property owner, and we've tried to, you know, make reasonable rentals to our tenants, but, you know, just like everybody else, we have to, you know, occasionally raise the rents because we have to pay more taxes, and the repairs cost a lot more. And one thing that I wanted to bring up was that it's a trickle-down effect because, for instance, you know, we had some friends that went to buy a unit in one of these new Kaka'ako developments, and when they got there, the developer told them, hey, I'm sorry, we're not selling. We're selling only to our friends and investors. So, they were turned away. So what that means is once the units come online, those people who are investors and their friends are going to turn around and sell it for a higher profit. And that just trickles all the way down. And that's just the point that I wanted to make. It's a trickle-down effect. And I think more incentives have to be made for, you know, the people who do have some rentals that are trying to provide this service for people.
Tom, very quickly, you mentioned that you have a rental space and that you were looking to put that on. Now that we have ADUs in Honolulu that will be coming online, are you looking to see that happen more for people who are, you know, strangers to your family? What's your criteria for bringing somebody in? Because the concern is that these units will be really developed for people's families, which is a good thing, because maybe you'll be keeping somebody from becoming homeless a little later on, perhaps a kid. But for the great pool of people who are still looking for housing, that maybe it won't make as much of a dent as maybe some of the, you know, the conversation would like to make it out to be.
Well, being, you know, an investor who, you know, I used to live in these places, so now I've moved on. But, you know, we're looking for a clientele that can afford it and it's dependable and it's not going to give us, you know, headaches. And that's hopefully somebody with a steady job. But, you know, we understand that as people are being more and more pressured in their jobs and it's getting harder and harder just to make it, a lot of people aren't really don't have that kind of savings. So, you know, I mean, it's a lot of people are just a couple paychecks away from being homeless. And, you know, I mean, we're trying to look for the best quality of candidate we can have. But, yeah.
All right, Tom. Thanks very much for the call. And if
all right.
And he's making the point that we've heard a lot of the time that, you know, people want to make sure, and this is understandable, that whoever they bring into a unit that they own is going to be reliable, not cause them, you know, undue headaches, and not be scary for a lot of people. That's really an issue, too.
And with landlord-tenant, you know, regulations, they're, you know, in other words, once you get someone in, it's much harder to get them out than it is to just be more discerning to start with.
So what we have talked about internally as providers is how can we come up with similar programs like the Mainland has done, for example. And so that comes down to, we talked about this ad nauseum and among us, ourselves as providers. It comes down to three things for someone like Tom, who has an investment and wants to protect his investment, but it's willing to help the community. And so that is, as a provider organization, what can we do to help guarantee that the rent's always going to be paid, that if there's any damages, that we're going to be there to repair it, and if there's any problems, we're going to be able to respond. And those are the three things that landlords always want. I wish there were more incentives for people with such good intentions that have this community spirit that want to help out. It'd be nice if we could provide tax breaks. Maybe that'll come on in the future. But at least we as providers can help assist with at least those three areas.
And be that intermediary.
That's right. Be the rent, repairs, and response for problems.
All right. If you'd like to join us, there's plenty of time if you get on the phone now. 941-3689. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Sarah calling us from Maui. Aloha, Sari. Thank you for your patience.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. What I'm calling about is the homeless, but is there any resource or some incentive where we can have the homeless live with a private party that needs yard work or housework, you know, that type of thing, you know, where we can get a homeless to come over and help? I'm so nervous. It's
okay, Sarah. It's all right. But you're coming up with some creative solutions and looking at, you know, how do you help and what can you do and what would make some sense. So let's ask our panel. She's trying to find some way of saying, how do you connect to these people and be able to maybe give them a job, albeit maybe short term or small, but to do something? Is there something that, you know, everyone might be able to figure out a way to do in the way that she's suggesting? Who wants to tackle that one first? All right, Greg,
I'll
it looks like
in,
you're
but,
up.
Sarah, I think Sarah was from Maui, is that correct?
Yes.
So, for example, there are many provider organizations on Maui. My organization has, we have locations on Maui as well. There may be, very well be, ways to partner with folks like Sarah who have some really good ideas on how the community can respond. And it may very well be that there are things like, just like that, where there may be ways that we can partner with local with some local folks who might have jobs that people can be paid for and help supplement their income.
And capturing that labor that may be there just waiting to do something. I know, like, there are other cities in Los Angeles, they're legendary. There are just corners where you know people are going to be who want, you know, short-term jobs for the day, for the week, what have you. But there's a lot of slippage there, to put it mildly, and there's not a whole lot of control over all of that. You're just kind of just finding people. She's looking for something that has more of a network to it, and you say that that might be something.
Well, there is the Partners in Care on Oahu is the continuum of care, and on the neighbor islands it's called Bridging the Gap.
Yeah, right.
And so there are several organizations on Maui, for example, and the other islands that actually provide that service. So getting in touch with provider organizations and come up with some creative ideas. So I think the idea we should entertain as a good one and see how can we do that so that it's going to be legal and everybody's going to be able to, there's not going to be anybody being exploited or taken advantage of either on either side. Good ideas, and those kind of ideas are what we need to really get the community engaged.
Some of that comes down to building relationships with people, and we've heard that over this entire week, that it's not just saying, okay, you're homeless, you need a job, but in some cases it's just, as one of the guests said, paying attention to who's in front of you.
Well, and I think it comes back to that idea of community. It's remembering that these are members of our community, and how can we integrate them better into a community, because a community is a support network. And really, we want to make sure that we're supporting every member of our community, regardless of, where they're at in terms of, homeless, sheltered, unsheltered, etc.
All right, we're going to go to Ben calling us from Kahana Bay. Aloha, Ben. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Ben Schaefer. Hey, I have, by the way, Hiki Health Center is doing a wonderful job. So I just have a couple of items I wanted to bring up. Republicans, back in when Clinton was the president, they had the contract with America, and part of their contract was to cut benefits for those in housing. And I think that's where the start of our homeless problem came up. Number two, we need to put that back in place, because then everybody can go back home. Those in the mainland, they can go back home and apply for those things. It was way cheaper than having them live on the road. Number two, our military takes up a lot of housing. So they need to move back on the base if they can. Number three, the containers that was brought up. If every construction company decided to donate or cocoa one container with everything already inside, it will cost the state nor the county any money. They could put their names on the outside as advertisement, this is what we can do, or the least amount of money with the biggest bang. And number four, it needs to be non-profits running it.
All right. Well, I think that last part especially, you've gotten a lot of nods around the head. Thanks so much for calling us. Of some of his ideas, what do you think would be workable? Is there something in there that Ben said might be in terms of the containers and looking at that? Because we've talked about tiny houses and what would that look like, and we've talked about looking at containers and being able to build those in, how many people could be there. But he's saying that somehow giving different companies the bang for their buck and being able to somehow underwrite it and donate some of that and making it a community-wide or industry-wide effort.
And getting the free advertising. I mean, I think that's a great idea.
I think that what we've heard in the last couple of callers that have called in is some community spirit, people trying to figure out how they can contribute. And those are great ideas. Why not do that? That's a good idea. We need to think through it, put it together, but those are that's a great option. That's a good way for the community to get involved.
All right, we've got more callers on the line. Andrew calling us from Mililani. Aloha, Andrew. Mm-hmm. Welcome to Town Square. Andrew, you there?
Oh, yeah. Hi. Can you
hi
hear
there.
Me? I was just wondering if it was another Andrew.
Nope, it's you.
Okay, great. I hear all these great ideas, and I'm sure everybody in Hawaii who's working maybe at the executive levels, the director's levels, and also just for all the, all the under levels as well for these organizations. And we're talking about how we can put together these great ideas to create a system tangibly, but even using technology, if there's something that we could use using the technology, almost like a Kickstarter, and just start this living project where people can visit it through mobile application or just online through tablet or PC, and then see how the living space through technology and all these great minds, how they would be able to come together and we'll build something together online. I think that might be an idea of how we can more collaborate using technology.
All right.
And all the great ideas as well.
All right.
I travel quite a bit for business and for one great idea for housing, like the Jeonse system in Korea, where homeowners, they can, instead of renting out, they're given money from from the rent from the people who, it's kind of like a lease, like a 2-year lease for $100,000. And it's up to the homeowner to figure out how they're going to invest that money in order to regain what the amount that they usually would make from rent. But then after 2 years is up, they give the whole $80,000 from the renter back to the renter. So it's all these different interesting ideas that we could put together. But I think we should use the technology to see how we can come together and build this living project.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much for those suggestions. I was watching Scott Fujii nod at you as you were talking. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, and I think, you know, from the provider standpoint, we certainly do want to start to look at how can we get everybody into the 21st century. And I think, you know, one thing, and because of what Focus does, you know, I always think back to data and making sure that, you know, how can we use technology to really inform what we need to do moving forward, and then use that information to get the community together and say, here's what we're really looking at. What are your thoughts on this? How can we tackle this? What do you bring to the table so that we can collaboratively look at these ideas and these problems?
All right, we're going to try to slip in one more call, but I know you want to answer that very briefly.
No, just to piggyback on what Scott was saying, I think that information, that knowledge is very, very helpful. People make stuff up, and what we've discovered with Scott and I, we met with some local media people this week, and we discussed the idea of having a public dashboard. Where are we on takedown targets? Where are we with homelessness? So we have a takedown target every week so people can see it, and then we have a community dashboard. We know what's going on.
All right. That would be a fabulous idea. We're going to take one last caller, Mark, calling us from Honolulu. We're really tight for time. Mark, can you do it quickly?
I'll try to do it quickly. So first of all, I think that what we should do is one of the things we should start enforcing the panhandling law, because we do have a panhandling law in Honolulu. I'm from Honolulu my whole life, and I just can't believe that these people that are occupying the streets and living there, they are dangerous. They're like on drugs. They're mentally ill. There's so many mentally incapable of making decisions that we think they can make. So I think we have to be realistic about the reality of the situation.
Okay, well, I'm going to stop you there because I want to get you an answer before we have to say goodbye. He's saying that, you know, hand in hand with this, you have to be able to enforce the panhandling law. How do you each feel about that very quickly?
I think we need to enforce the rules that are in society without making criminals of our homeless people.
Scott?
I absolutely agree with what Greg says, and I think, you know, it's a question of engagement. It's a question of getting out to those folks and making sure that they're really getting the services that they need.
And Sheila?
Likewise, not all the people are there because they're, you know, criminals. And, you know, a lot of the people lost jobs in the economic downturn. So I think that we definitely need to engage them and develop relationships.
And from what I'm hearing from all of you and what we've talked about over the week is really understanding that we have so many different people who are all labeled as being homeless. And unless there's some real relationship and understanding where those people really are, that sometimes people can look very scary, but perhaps not at all be scary. They're just simply just as scared and just mm-hmm. as caught.
Absolutely.
All right. I want to thank all of you for being willing to come out tonight. We just scratched the surface. We'll get together and do it again not too long from now. But Greg Payton from Partners in Care, Scott Fujii from Focused, and Sheila Beckham from Waikiki Health Center, thank you so much for all the time tonight. And before we go, just want to give you a quick catch-up that as we've been on the air talking tonight, we know that we've been having an early bird campaign running yesterday, today, and tomorrow for the station to be able to see what kind of a dent we can put into the pledges before we hit the air in a couple of weeks. We have thanks to give to Margaret King, to Andrea Gill, and to Linda Bernstein for calling in. And now we have 300 early bird pledges and 20 new members. Thank you all very much for your concern and care for this station. And keep calling, and we'll hope that we'll have even more to tell you about tomorrow morning when we get together for the conversation right here at 8 o'clock. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Take good care of yourselves. Aloha.